Hi, my name's Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
Uriah Heep and Easy Living from their fourth studio album, Demons and Wizards. That was released on May the 19th, back in 1972 on the Bronze Record label in the UK and Mercury in the US. And it sold 3 million copies.
Well, it's a great song. That's why we've got it on. It's a good song, but...
Great show opener as well. Good
yeah,
feel.
Yeah, it is. Great organ, you know, but I always thought Ken Hensley was in the shadow of John Lord and the whole band really are in the shadow of Deep Purple because Mick Box, I've never really liked his guitar playing, you know. David Byron's vocal, good vocal, you know. Gary yeah. Thayne on bass. I think this is the best lineup that they had.
And I don't know any of these people's names, by the way.
Well, I got a couple of albums because really I was at that time, you know, when they were around, I was just scooping up loads and loads of vinyl, you know, and the stuff from around about that era and listening to it. But it never got me like they did Deep Purple or Zeppelin, you know.
It was really weird because I was trying to place them to know kind of where they fitted in the sort of musical history. They were saying that Uriah Heep's a progressive rock institution and they were alongside bands like Deep Purple, Queen, Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin, and they helped lay the foundation for the United Kingdom's vibrant, hard rock, heavy metal scene. And they had hits, obviously, like Easy Living, The Wizard, Sweet Lorraine and stuff. And they formed in 1969. So that's where they sit along with their peers, like you say. So if you're thinking, you compare them to Deep Purple, don't you, really?
Well, I know Ken McKennicky, who listens to the
show,
he'll be very,
Ken.
Very keen about this track. He loves that you're either Heap.
Oh, and he loves his music as well, you know,
oh,
really,
does.
And a great supporter of our band. So, yeah, it's great to see, you know, to hang out with somebody who's got passion for music.
Yeah. And what I do like it. I really like the organ sound on this. And the drum sound's a bit compressed. But apparently this was done at Lansdowne Studios. And as I said, and it was done through a Cadac board. So we like Cadac boards, yeah. And it's definitely got a very cohesive sound, you know. It's very, very powerful.
Yeah.
Very powerful.
It's like a tapestry of the time. You can feel it, can't you, in the music it's of its time, very much in that era. And you know, they've had a 49-year career, and over the course of their career, they've released 25 studio albums, 2 albums of re-recorded material, 18 live albums, and 39 compilation albums, and they've sold over 40 million albums worldwide.
Well, it can't be that bad, can they, really? Notice also, no guitar solo in that. Now, I wonder who that is. Yes, Queen. Now I'm Here, from their third album, Sheer Heart Attack, released on 8th of November 1974 on the EMI label in the UK and Elektra in the US.
Finally, we felt it was the right time to get some Queen on the show. Because they've been there. We've just, because a lot of the time we sort of program the show on how we feel, don't we? And it just Absolutely. Felt right this week to, and also with stories of the new film, the Queen film out, it just kind of felt quite topical.
Yeah, and it's also the only Queen album I've got on vinyl, because I never really liked them, to tell you the truth. Later on, I all got a bit pompous. Yep, true. Again, love Brian May, love the songs, love really everything about them, but I just didn't like, I loved them live, watching them live, they were great live, you know, but I don't know. But the reason why I love this track, it's one of those undiscovered riffs of rock that is probably, it's amazing. It's a great riff. That da-da-da, it's written by Brian May, of course, so it was, you know, it's all about the riff. And it sounds amazing to me. I just love it. And the sad guitar sound, it's not too dirty, it's gritty, it's real rock and roll, you know? That's what I like about it. Great.
I just think it's like, just reminded me of a bit of a Monty Python moment, the undiscovered whiff of what?
Well,
I'm so glad you said that, because I know that's what I've just done what I've just done, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, and it was recorded principally at Trident Studios, a lot of it, wasn't it? Because were they on the Trident label? What was that?
Well,
Neptune,
yeah.
Is it called?
I mean, it's just, there's just this whole adventure, you know, because everyone knows Queen. I mean, I do. Loads of people do. But I was just thinking, what happens if you don't? So, in terms of studios, they went to Air, Rockfield, Trident, and Wessex Sound Studios. Mm. And I went on, like, you know, this little adventure down like rabbit warrens and stuff, because it was produced by a guy called Roy Thomas Baker. And yep. I was thinking, well, who's he? And this guy began his career at Decca Records at the age of 14, and there was a music producer he was working with called Gus Dudgeon, and he soon moved to Trident Studios, and he worked with Dudgeon, Tony Visconti,
that's right,
Mick Jagger and Keith Richards and Frank Zappa, as well as recording artists like the Rolling Stones, David Bowie, The Who, Nazareth, Santana, the Mothers of Invention, Bebop Deluxe, T-Rex. Can you imagine working the studios with all these amazing bands? And he also produced the Free album Fire and Water in 1970.
Indeed, with All Right Now and all those, Mr. Big and all those great songs. You know?
I don't know what's happening to me now, because I get so excited when I meet somebody, or I get to know about somebody who connects in all my favourite albums and my favourite musicians. And what happened was he co-founded Neptune, which is Trident's record company, and that's right. When Baker met Queen.
Yes.
So he worked on five of their albums, and he won a Grammy Award and the Guinness World Records for their hit song Bohemian Rhapsody. So this is the guy, Roy Thomas Baker, quite connected in terms of how Queen managed to grow and become the band that they, you know, were and are today, in a way.
Well, those backing vocals, that's what I love about the Queen, that very high backing vocal, which is Roger Taylor, you know. Roger Taylor does all the very high stuff. And you know, the drum sound, big kick drum sound, but the guitar sound, that homemade guitar through an AC30, you can really hear it on that, you know. It's not too over-processed, just beautiful, man, beautiful. And John Deacon, I mean, you know, But it's like we see all the time with bands. There are halcyon days. It's like that, you know, the Deep Purple thing going back to Purple with, you know, Glover and Gillan, and that original lineup was brilliant, you know, Men in Japan. And they just had that moment of brilliance, you know. And the really amazing bands keep that going for ages. I mean, you know, Zeppelin, you know, it was the four members. It wasn't any one of them that were actually, without, you know, if one of them dropped out, they wouldn't have been the same. And I think certainly the same with Queen. And I think when Roger Deacon left, it was a sad day, really, you know, because it was the end of that Queen thing, you know, the proper Queen thing.
I keep giggling to myself thinking about what it was like to be in the studio when they were recording this, you know. I bet they had a laugh as well, you know. I mean, I know they're very professional and wanted to really get it right, but just the vision that they had, I think I commend, I really love that, you know, because you go into a studio and you've got this vision and all you're writing and you're in that creative process. How blinking marvellous is that?
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing the film, because we haven't seen it yet. I mean,
no,
hopefully we'll be able to see it.
Well, our mate Dave Sundells has been to see it twice, hasn't he? He loves it.
He has indeed. And of course, we're on tour next week, so we'll be, hopefully, a bit of time off at the end.
Yeah,
should
we go to the movies together?
Yeah, I think we should go on a date. Let's do it. Let's go to Manchester. is you're going to have a curry down Wilmslow Road and then go and watch a movie. How's that?
Deal.
I love the sound of breaking glass, especially when I'm lonely. I need the noises of destruction.
Nick Lowe, and I love the sound of breaking glass. That was all glass.
I was about to pick you up on that when you went glass.
Oh, no, it just sounded weird then, didn't it? That was released as a single on the 17th of February 1978 on the Radar record label and also featured on his solo debut album, Jesus of Cool, which is also released in 1978, and it went to number 7 in the UK singles chart.
Critically acclaimed as well, that album.
Indeed.
Yeah, really good work. Now, you know, Uriah Heep, didn't have a big fan of, really, or Queen, you know, saw him 5 times, but never really massive fan of the studio albums. Now, Nick Lowe, different kettle of fish, great producer, a great British sound. He had a British sound. It is different. It's not like an American thing going on. You know, love the little bass line on that. Of course, he's a bass player. And, you know, he's a great songwriter. He's a great songwriter. Him and Dave Edmunds together, you know, I mean, doing some great stuff. But on there was all the, I mean, Norman Watroy was one of the tracks, of course, the bass. But, you know, I mean, he's everywhere. He's like, you know.
I know.
Incredible. And Dave Edmunds, of course, you know. And it was a great, great time. And one of the other things I just wanted to bring up is that it's really marking the demise of the really super studio, because this was actually recorded in Rickmansworth, you know, and it's Chalk Farm, Eden, Jackson Studios, Pathway, was it? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But these are not like the big ones from the early 70s, like Air and Trident and all those. You know, there'd been a proliferation of studios, and some of the older ones couldn't make the business model work anymore and closed down. So it was a new thing. And yeah. It was a new wave of music as well. And with new ideas, and you can hear it. In the production, you know, it's very detailed, and he really knows what he's doing. Well, waiting on enough now.
No. Do you know the only because Nick Lowe always was around him when I was growing up because of the Rockfield Studios connection.
Yeah,
and so that for me, it was always like I remember hearing "Cruel to Be Kind." I think my sister Dawn had it on
great
7-inch. Love it. And it's like one of my favourite records still because I love the melody, and I guess Nick Lowe's one of these kind of enigmas where I've never really met him and I've not, you know, been around that scene, but I knew he was just down the road doing this thing. And it's and then when you look at when I was doing the research and you see what he looks like, it's like, oh, that's what you look like then. Yeah. It's really obscure to know about somebody, but you can't put a visual reference to them as well.
Yeah.
Odd. But I didn't know that he was a producer for Stiff Records, and he'd recorded loads of records like Elvis Costello and the Pretenders and the Damned, and that he was basically involved with, he was the leader of this seminal pub rocking band called the Brinsley Schwartz Band.
That's right.
And he had a considerable influence over the development of punk rock.
Mm.
I mean, you just don't expect Nick Lowe to be associated with the development of punk rock.
Well, you know, he really is a super cool guy. He's one of the sort of guys I would love to go to the pub with. And there's not many people in the rock and roll business, to say the truth, because most of them are, well, I can't say it on air. But
okay.
But they are, you know, but this guy, I think he's cool. And I don't think he's got any edge to him. I think you've met him, you know, and every few pints. And Dave Edmunds as well, he seems a really nice bloke, you know. Whipping out his sabre dance and all that sort of carry on, you know.
We should get my ex-brother-in-law, Nick Stevens, to come down as well. And we'll all just hang out, all guitar people.
Yeah.
Do you know what his nickname is? Because he's got this rough and ragged production style.
Go on.
Basher.
Nobody sees.
Kevin Coyne and Eastbourne Ladies from the double album Marjorie Razorblade, fantastic name, released in October 1973 on Virgin Records when they were only 4 months old.
Mike Oldfield had just released his magnificent, that actually got him going, didn't it, really?
It is. His album. They were the second artists to be signed.
After Oldfield,
yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely, yeah. Now, I don't know. I don't know anything about Kevin Coyne.
Well, you know, I don't really. I've got the album, but it's like really odd in the fact that we sort of just picked it out and we were listening to some stuff. And it jumps out, this track, because, you know, when I put it on, it's a bit like Van, you know, Van Morrison. He's got a sort of Van Morrison-y voice, and it sounds a lot earlier than it is. The guitar's quite thin, and
I don't know what's going on with the drums. It sounds like they've replaced them with cardboard boxes.
Yeah, well, it's a real woofy sound, isn't it?
It's really odd, though, isn't it? But there's a lot of jinga, 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 jing. There's a load of rhythm that goes on that kind of keeps the momentum of the song.
Well, it was produced by Steve Verrocker,
which is not Verrocker and not Verrucker.
No, but Verrocker, who worked with Link Wray, of course.
Of course.
And recorded at the Manor and sat in the studio. And the Manor, of course, had just been, I think it had just been kicked off by Branson then, you know, because that was their studio.
And
it has a very unusual sound, but I really like it. It's got a sort of bounce to it. Mm. And then you know, there's a bit of Doors influence in there and stuff as well. But apparently he's... he passed away when he was in Germany, I think.
Adopted
home in Nuremberg, yeah. And he was like an anti-star, wasn't he?
Yeah, this is the weirdest thing. And yet, you know, I can totally get that. He was basically, on his website, he just said he had an uncompromising attitude towards showbiz fame and fortune, and that inevitably left him in a little bit of an outside position. So I think what really... I mean, he was born in Derby in 1944, and I think what really formed him, he was, as most people were sort of at that time in early post-war Britain, they went to art school. Remember we were saying the other day,
right,
like everybody seemed to be an art school student in those days, which, you know, I love. And but what really shaped him, apparently, was that he spent 3 years working as a social therapist and psychiatric nurse at Whittingham Hospital near Preston. And then he moved down to London and he was a drugs counsellor in Soho.
No.
The Soho Project, yeah. So that's why I think a lot of his lyrics are dark, and because he's actually dealing with real life darkness, I guess, and the sad edge of the world. And then what happened, this is lovely though, right? So John Coyne, yeah. And then what happened? Guess who got hold of a demo for his band? Because he met up with a guy called Dave Clegg, who was the bass player from the Bonzo Dog
Doodah.
I can't even say it. It's not even an R.
Yeah.
The Bonzo Dog Doodah Band.
Yes.
Yeah, so anyway, John Peel.
No.
John Peel gave them their break. He signed them to his own record label. Did you know that? He had a record label.
Dandelion Records.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Ah, yeah, I knew.
But that means if you pick it, you wet the bed. It's a joke. Dandelions is like when you... It's
is
like,
that right?
Yeah. Do you not have that when you were a child?
No.
We couldn't touch dandelions because otherwise you'd wet the bed.
No, I didn't know that.
That's an old wives' tale. It's funny,
certainly
isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, John Peel gave them their break before they signed to Virgin.
Well, I didn't know that. There you go. Well, Viv Stanshall, I bumped into him a couple of times when I was in London. Viv Stanshall, very unusual guy. He was a Bonzo Dog main. The head honcho, really, but on that record as well, Gene Russell was on piano there. I think that's how you pronounce it. And he, very, very famous. He's worked with literally everybody. If you look at his Wikipedia site, it says work with, and it's about 4 pages long of just who he's worked with. But I sort of came across him first when he was playing piano with Cat Stevens.
Right.
Great piano player. But the rest of the band were pretty unknown as well. And I think he sort of surrounded himself with people who he just wanted to be with and make music with, as opposed to any other motivation, like you say, like fame or fortune.
And do you know, the lasting story about John is that he turned down a meeting with the founder of Elektra Records, a guy called Jack Holtzman, and he wanted to meet him to discuss him taking Jim Morrison's place in the Doors.
No.
Yeah, and he didn't turn up, he turned the meeting down, and he gave the reason that he didn't fancy wearing leather trousers.
I learned the truth at 17, their love was meant for beauty queens, in high school girls with clear skin smiles, who married young and then retired. The Valentines I never knew, the Friday night charades of youth, were spent on one more beautiful. At 17 I learned the truth. And those of us with ravaged faces, lacking in the social graces, desperately remained at home, inventing lovers on the phone, who called to say, come dance with me, and murmured vague obscenities. It isn't all it seems. It's 17. A brown-eyed girl in hand-me-downs, whose name I never could pronounce, said, pity please the ones who serve, they only get what they deserve. In the rich relationed hometown queen marries into what she needs with a guarantee of come. Remember those who win the game, lose the love they sought to gain, in debentures of quality and dubious integrity. The small town eyes will gape at you in dull surprise when payment due exceeds accounts received at 17.
Listening to the Supertone Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And that was Janice Ian at 17 from her seventh studio album Between the Lines, released in March 1975 on Columbia label and also as a single 6 months later.
What a beautiful voice.
What a great lyric. I learned the truth at 17 that love was meant for beauty queens and high school girls with clear skinned smiles who married young and then retired. Wow. The opening lines of the song. That is a killer. That is just getting your sabre out and just going woof, 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 woof. Great lyric. I've always loved this record, you know. And a friend of mine, a guy called Graham Allen from school, introduced me to Janis Ian. Oh, in the early 70s. Tim Wright and myself and Graham were friends at the time. And I haven't seen him for years, actually. He's a doctor, I think. He's a doctor in the... anyway, he's gone in the Air Force. But he turned me on and to this woman, and I love the song. It's a shame about the production. I think the production's slightly cheesy because I think they tried to do a Karen Carpenter on it. You know,
noticing that with the horn section as well.
And also, there's a bit of a cock up in the horns in the middle. There's a bit of a... You can hear... he's just actually done a bit of a raspberry on the mouthpiece there. It's all right. Nice close mic'ing. But it's... it always amazes me when you listen to a song like that and the production, the difference between American production and British. Because that was done at 914 Studios in New York, where Bruce Springsteen recorded and... He started his studio career in that studio. And it's so clean and pure, and all the musicians are really good, and it's quite boring because it's so good, you know. I'll tell you one thing, though, and I'm sorry for just cutting across you here, but the bass on that was lovely.
I thought that too. What a beautiful tone.
It was.
And the movement was perfect.
A perfect movement and a great... accompaniment. It's a shame, actually, they didn't just have the acoustic guitar and the bass and then just some more incidental, you know, it's got to have a groove to it, you know, drums, but it would have been
back for another instrument for a motif, but it's better. I'm glad they had the horns and not the saxophone, though, because that really would have been dead in the water. Come on. I mean, it's not dated as well as the horn section, is it, really?
Well,
it's still very
contemporary. Right. Yeah, I get
but
that.
What I didn't realise about Janis is that she won a Grammy Award for that, for Best Female Pop Vocal Performance in 1976, and she beat the likes of Linda Ronstadt, Olivia Newton-John and Helen Reddy, and she was nominated for Record of the Year and Song of the Year. Hmm. So, I mean, this is quite beautiful. And she you know, when she was two, she started going, right, I'm going to learn piano. So at the age of two, she was like, getting piano lessons.
Sounds a bit like you.
Well, this is the weirdest thing, right? Because even though we didn't have a piano at home because Mum had, I don't know, we had a piano that was my grandfather's, and by the time we moved to this other house, it wasn't there anymore. I think it's probably because we didn't have enough room, I'm not quite sure. But so anytime I used to go to a house at the piano, it was like calling me. It was like, oh, and it's like, I try and just like edge over to it, and I just sit there, and it's the most magical thing when you're sat on a stool with this keyboard and you press, and it's like, wow. So anyway, I can really understand that. But she played, and I played recorder, but she played harmonica, and mm-hmm. I got a harmonica when I was about eight, and guitar and French horn.
No, is that right?
Yeah, which is my instrument.
Yeah.
So that's really, every time I come across somebody who's played the French horn, I'm like, yes. It's very much kind of connected to that, really. But I love her. And do you know what I'm so grateful for is that actually I love the tone of her voice, that it's creamy. There's not too much vibrato, because there were other artists, female artists of that time, where I really find it hard to connect in with the music because the voice is so high and so shrill and so...
Yeah.
And I can't... But this, her voice, is perfect to really just, you know, it's like diving into the sea and just letting it take you somewhere beautiful.
Yeah, well, the lyric, melody, utter genius, where I'm concerned. Thank you.
the magnificent Goldfrapp and Strict Machine from their second studio album, Black Cherry. That was released on the 23rd of April in 2003 on the Mute record label and released as the album's second single a couple months later in July. And it reached the top 30 in the UK charts, went up to the UK top 20 a year later, and was a huge hit in America. It went to number one in the dance club chart.
Yeah.
I mean, what a song.
What a sound. You've got to love Alison Goldfrapp, you know, because I've seen her a couple of times live, sort of accidentally, really, because at festivals and stuff. But it's very captivating.
Yeah.
And she's very, very rude, actually. Quite, you know, quite on stage. Very, very, what's the word?
Naughty.
Naughty. No. That's the best word for it.
No, she was
a very naughty girl. But it was good.
No, actually, I'll tell you what she is. I think she's just very much enjoying her womanhood.
Mm.
And she's a performance artist, you see, as well. So she's a dancer. She's a performance. She uses her body as an expression. It's not just a vocal performance that she gives. It's a whole 360.
Well, it was a brilliant show anyway. I mean, there's only two of them. So it's, you know, and that's all about analog synth for me. And I just love big, fat, thick analog synth. And the production is absolutely superb. You know, a lovely job. Because it's not just the vocal and the song, but
the
Will
textures,
Gregory. Yeah,
my goodness.
Yeah, Will Gregory did a great job on that, and apparently they recorded a lot of it at a home studio in a bit of a dodgy area of Bath, a sort of bohemian area of Bath.
A darkened basement.
Is that right? Yeah,
that's what they say. I've read that on a couple of times. The darkened basement thing. Yeah, so they could concentrate.
But that's the cool thing about electronic music is that, there's a lot of very cool things about electronic music. You don't really need a big space. You can do it in a relatively small room, you know, and we're a rock and roll band with drums and all that. You do need a bigger space.
Well, we released an EP, an electronic EP.
We did.
With our band Electrolyte.
We did indeed. I wasn't going to mention that, but there we are.
Well, why not?
Look it up on Wikipedia. Yeah.
We're musicians, so we use different, we have different instruments and things. We love analog, but it's great. I love that experiment. I loved it. I loved the whole experience of it.
Well, it was, yeah, I really enjoyed it too. It was great, you know.
That surprised you, didn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah. I didn't think you mentioned that. But yeah, but we loved this whole electronic thing as well, you know. A few weeks ago we had on Blue Monday and New Order when that, you know, electronic thing was really happening. But these are great, great sounds, you know. And whether you like Uriah Heep with that big, thick organ sound or you like this with the big, thick synth sound, you know, it's just cool.
We gonna beat your ass.
Love Sculpture, Wang Dang Doodle from the debut album Blues Helping, released in 1968 on the Parlophone record label. Written, of course, by the lovely Whistling Willie Dixon.
Yep.
You know, one of our favourite blues artists in terms of songwriting, you know. Fernwood Road and lots of stuff. Yeah.
Love he's on, that.
You know, but featuring, of course, on guitar and vocals, Dave Edmunds, who has now made an appearance after the earlier appearance of his co-conspirator, Nick Lowe.
Nicely said.
And even you can hear in that, there's something about his playing, his production for 1968. It's a very unusual sound, and his guitar playing is really nice. Because on that album, of course, Sabre Dance is on. We'll put it on in some shows in the future. It's a great song. I mean, I remember watching that on Top of the Pops, and me eyes just came out like on storks. I thought, I want to be Dave Edmunds. It was great, you know. That was one of the things that really got me, and I'd forgotten about it until you played this album.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, it was produced by Kingsley Ward and Malcolm Jones, but not at Rockfield Studios. It was recorded at Abbey Road. Over a couple of months in 1968. Right. So that kind of surprised me then. But the thing with Dave Edmunds, though, they were saying that really Love Sculpture... I can't... It's such a funny name.
Love Sculpture.
It was really just all about him and Dave Edmunds and his playing and stuff. And you could, as you say, you can... But you can get that feel, can't you, of where he was going to move on to.
He's from Cardiff, isn't he?
I believe so. Well, time's up for this week, darling.
No.
Yep.
We've had a great show this week. I've really enjoyed it. It's very eclectic, isn't it?
Mm.
You know, the mix. All the way from Uriah Heep to Janis Ian and then...
I know, and I keep thinking about her voice, you know. It's really kind of enchanting.
Mm.
But if you want to keep in contact with us as well or give us any feedback about the show, we're on Instagram, Starlight Campbell, Twitter, at Susie with a Y and Simon, and, of course, in Facebook land.
Yeah, and the show's available on Mixcloud, Spotify, iTunes and iHeartRadio, so please tell your friends.
Indeed, and guess what we're going to play you out with this week's show? A band called Heads, Hands and Feet, plural, and a song called Country Boy from their album Heads, Hands and Feet, released in way back when, in 1971.
Well, I saw him. This is Albert Lee, the guitar player, one of the greatest country guitar players ever to walk the planet, really, with Emmylou Harris's band on the Ogre Russell Test, and they did this. And it was astounding. And this is a live version. Now, folks, this is live before editing. This is live before they had pieces of tape and all that. And it's a fierce performance indeed.
He's got a nice smile. It's a joke. Wow.
Well, his guitar player, though, is remarkable, you know, and the whole band were really great, and he's still working now, you know what I mean? He still goes out and bashes out Country Boy, and I saw it the other week, and he's not a young man anymore, but he ripped into it like a, you know, like a demon.
Do you know what's really interesting about them, though, is with the band, it only took them one gig to land what was at the time the biggest record advance ever offered by the US record industry to a UK band. It was $500,000 up front.
No.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Mahusiv. Yep. Incredible. And basically, they were looking back saying, we were one hell of a band, and on a good night, we could blow anyone off the stage.
Little blockhead, city slick, shining up through the street. Underneath, I'm just a cotton picker. He's blowing out of his mind. Show me where I start. By the words and call. I'm just a cotton picker.
like a bang tap. He's pushing back to the bottom. But I'd rather be a hog swell chewing cud on the line. I'm just a little old cotton picker going out to the